children. So I hand over the mic to her.
This is November 8th.
Yes.
November 8th, 2013 in Houston. And we're going to meditate on the Dhamma Dharastika. Is that all right?
Jai.
Yes. There we go. All right. So I thought we would focus on text 5, unless one of you has a text. We could do that also if one of you has a text that you're like, oh, I really want to talk about that one. Then we could do that too. So anybody remember what text 5 is?
Text 5 of Dhamma Dharastika?
Mm-hmm. Anybody?
If you can tell the first
one. Okay, well, there's two texts that start with the same word. This is the second one of them. Yes, good. Very good.
Idam te mukham bhojan atyanta nirlay.
What's the rest of it? Somebody? Come on, ladies. I feel so lonely here. It's all the men over here, and you're all the way in the back. Come on. Otherwise, I'm going to feel bad. Come, please. Yes. Okay, maybe we can say it together. Idam te mukham bojam atyanta nilaya vritam kundalai snikarak chaishtukopyam. Muhushchum vitam bimbarakta dharane manasya virastam alam lakshalam. So this is a commentary by Sanatan Goswami. Sanatan Goswami wrote a commentary on each verse of the Dhamma Dharastika. So we're going to read his commentary on this verse. Okay, who knows the translation for this?
Bluish face.
Okay, bluish face. What else?
His face is like a bimba fruit, which is reddish.
Yes, his cheeks get like bimba fruit. Why do his cheeks get reddish? Because someone's kissing his cheeks. Yeah. Okay, a gopi is kissing his cheeks. And what else does the verse say?
What is the second part?
Okay, we have idam te mukham bojam atyanta nilaya vritam kundalai. What's kundalai?
Hearing.
So it's an answer swing to and fro. Nigda rakchaistugopya. Rakchaistugopya, it's rakta. It's red from the gopi. Muhushchumbitam bimba rakta dharame. It's red. It's another rakta. So two raktas. One is a reddish tint in the hair and one is red on the cheek. Manas avirastam alam lakshalabhai. What's a laksha?
The aim,
the goal, target. Your target, your goal. So I don't want any other goal, manas, but to have this vision in my mind. Generally, we have so many visions in our mind. Correct? Yes. Whenever you start, just like we're starting a school, so the first thing we did was we figured out the, what do? You're going to start something. First you have to have a?
Vision.
A vision. You have to know where you're going. Like we got in the car this evening, we had to know where we're going. I mean, when I was a teenager, sometimes we used to just drive nowhere. That was when gas was 27 cents a gallon. Just go for a drive. I don't think anybody does that anymore. But you have a destination. So usually we have something that's in our mind as our destination. What are we meditating on? We're meditating on the car we want to buy, or we're meditating on what we want to cook for dinner, or we're meditating on the report we have to get done by tomorrow, or right? Something like that. We have some goal that we're meditating on. So here are the prayers. I want my goal in my mind to be this vision of Krishna's face. So let's read the commentaries and Sanatana Goswami. And furthermore, the longing to see your Srimukha, your divine lotus face, that is Parama Manohara, supremely enchanting. Manohara means what? Mana means mind. Hara means to steal the mind. It's stated in this verse, beginning with idam te. Sometime, while one is meditating deeply within and perceives such indescribable beauty and splendor, That is what is revealed in this verse. So in other words, if somebody is deep in meditation, they will factually see this vision. That's what they will actually see. Like I have one devotee friend who was telling me that one day she heard her spiritual master saying that when you're not chanting attentively, it's like beating Krishna. And so she was very moved by this and decided, I don't want to beat Krishna anymore. So the next day during her japa, she was really giving her heart to her chanting. And then she had this vision of Krishna's face. She didn't see his whole face, but she said she saw the side of his face and his shoulder and his curling hair. And this very enchanting vision. So when one goes deep into meditation, one gets this enchanting vision of Krishna's face. Indescribable beauty and splendor. His face is Prafulla Kamalakara. It resembles a fully blossomed lotus flower. So there's some analogy to describe. So what is the most beautiful thing we think of in nature, like a blossomed lotus or a blossomed rose or something like that? So beauty, something like that, something enchanting that you can't stop looking at. You know, whenever we see even someone in this world that's very beautiful, there was a few months ago, I was giving a class in London to the youth group, and there was one girl in the audience that was so beautiful, like, you know, 1 in 10,000 sort of person. I mean, the people on the magazines, you know, they're not actually that beautiful, you know that. Lots of makeup and lots of photoshopping. So, but she wasn't like that, just that was what she looked like. And it was very hard when I was speaking not to look at her. You understand? It was very difficult. I kept having to force myself not to look at her. And afterwards I said, you know, you're very beautiful. I said, you should use this in service. She said, how can I use it in service? So it was, she was there with her fiancé, and I looked at him and I said, when you walk down the street with her, does everyone stare at you? He said, oh yeah, all the time. Wherever we go, everyone is simply staring. So I said, then if you talk about Krishna, when people stare at you, they'll get some benefit. If you have some tilak on, and, you know, I said, they're going to look at you anyway. You might as well have them think of Krishna when they're looking at you. So anything that's very beautiful that attracts us like that. Yes? Even something in nature, some beautiful scene in nature, some, you know, sunrise or the ocean or something, some beautiful mountain. We immediately become attracted. We become even mesmerized where you're practically just staring. You can't stop yourself. It requires great effort to stop yourself. So this is unbelievable with Krishna. I mean, if we take the most beautiful person on this planet, they're nothing compared to the beauty of the people on the higher planets. The most beautiful people on this planet look like frogs compared to the residents of Swargaloka. And they have no beauty compared to the residents of the higher planets even. What to speak of Krishna? Who's the sum total of all beauty. His face is a remover of all kinds of distress. So that also, whenever we have something very attractive, we forget about our distress. Isn't that a fact? Something's very, very, very beautiful and enchanting to us. We become absorbed in that, and all distress vanishes. So when we become absorbed in Krishna's beauty, then all feelings of, oh, this problem and that problem, we don't even remember them. They're simply gone. And Paramananda Rasa Maya, and it is pervaded with the supreme mellows of pure bliss. So not only is Krishna's face very beautiful, but it's full of pleasure. Krishna's form is concentrated pleasure, Akila Rasamrita Murti. His form is the substance or the sum of all rasas, of all tastes. So we are trying to get some pleasure, just like with food, we like different tastes. So today we were invited to lunch. It was a Chinese lunch, and there were many different tastes. There was like these very lightly steamed and fried vegetables, and each vegetable, I was thinking like that, each vegetable has a very distinct taste. Or this morning I was cutting up some fruit for my Giriraj, And as I was cutting the pears, the fragrance was in the kitchen as I was cutting. And I was thinking, each kind of fruit, it has its own particular taste. But then there are the six Ayurvedic tastes, sweet, salty, sour, bitter, pungent, and astringent. And we like some variety. You know, even if you like sweets, you don't want to eat only gulodrins. Even if you like them very much, you don't want to have simply gulodrins. You want some variety. You may like even some bitter mango, or you like something that's spicy, right? Some variety of taste. I had the great, I was very, very fortunate, very blessed to go to Manipur about a year ago for the first time. And the food they have there is exploding with flavor. So they make these leaf plates out of banana leaves to make, they sew two together and make a circle. And in the middle there's this huge mound of plain rice. And I'm thinking, there's no way I will ever eat all this rice. It's huge. And then around it there's little, just like a little tablespoon each, only 20 different preparations all around this rice. But I had to eat the rice because each preparation had so much flavor that if you ate it by itself it was too much almost. But all different. You know, one was very sweet, one was very sour, one was very bitter, one was very spicy. And all varieties. So just like with food, we like varieties. You know, the ice cream shops, they don't only sell vanilla. Can you imagine an ice cream shop, only vanilla? Nobody would go there. 30 flavors, 50 flavors. And in Dubai, we have an ice cream shop that has Sitapal ice cream and Chiku ice cream. It's worth going to Dubai just to go to the ice cream shop. So there's all different rasas. So we think about the five primary rasas of awe and reverence and service, friendship, parental, conjugal. But there's also seven secondary rasas. There's comedy and joy. There's fear. There's anger. There's compassion. Or also that's in like sadness. You know, like if you read a sad story, you see a sad movie and you cry, so that's Karuna Ras. There's ghastly Ras also. So there's all, and these are all different flavors of pleasure. Of course, in this world, none of these things are pleasurable. Even joy in this world is not really pleasurable. Have you ever thought about that? It's not really expensive pleasure. But on the spiritual platform, even things like sadness or compassion or things like fear or anger, even ghastliness, they're full of taste. So Krishna's face is the repository of all tastes, of all different varieties of pleasure. When we talk about supreme pleasure in bhakti, we're not talking about just some sort of vanilla or ice cream without any vanilla in it. Can you imagine ice cream with no flavor at all? So we're not talking like that. We're talking about all varieties. I mean, we can just imagine in this planet, Srila Prabhupada says this planet is the lowest of the middle planets. So just like here we have middle class, and then we have the lower middle class, and we have the upper middle class, and then you've got the upper class, and you've got the lower upper class, right? And the middle upper class, and the upper class, the 1% who fly in private jets. They don't even fly first class, they fly in private jets. And then you have the lower class, but then you have the lower class that's homeless in the street, right? So all variety. So Srila Prabhupada says this planet is the lowest of the middle planets. The very lowest of the middle planets. So like, you know, if you really work your way up from poverty and you just cross the line into middle class, you know, you're just barely in middle class. So that's what this planet is. This planet is, we just barely made it to the middle class. And yet there's so much variety on this planet. So many varieties of tastes. So I give the example so many times. Do we need all these kinds of vegetables? I mean, to live, for nutrition, do you need all these varieties of vegetables? Certainly not. What to speak of varieties of varieties? There's so many different kinds of squash. Right, there's so many different kinds of fruit, and then there's kinds of kinds. There's so many kinds of apples. There's so many kinds of tomatoes. I remember when I went to Trinidad, so they greeted me and they said, "We want to give you a really special gift." It was all wrapped up and everything, and I opened it, and it was a red, delicious apple. Because in Trinidad, they don't grow apples. So it's very special. It was very expensive for this one apple. I said, you know, I have apples all the time. I was hoping for a mango. And she said, oh, here the mangoes are lying on the street. And she said, which kind of mango do you want? We have 40 kinds of mangoes. 40 mangoes. So I said, you know where I'm from? We have 40 kinds of apples. So if in this lowest of the middle planet, there's so many hundreds of kinds of fruit, and then if each kind of fruit, there's, you know, four dozen kinds of mangoes, and 4 dozen kinds of pears, and 4 dozen kinds. Just imagine what it is like on the middle planets, or what it is like in the upper planets, where they fly there, they can fly without a plane. They don't even need their own private plane. On the upper planets, they want to go someplace, they just go. So imagine the variety there, the variety of colors, the variety of taste, the variety of food, the variety of enjoyment. So much more than we can imagine. Just like even on this planet, somebody who's in poverty, they can't imagine the enjoyment of somebody who has more wealth. So what to speak of in Krishna, who's the top of the top of the top of the top of the top. Mata Vajram Nanya. There's nothing higher than me, Krishna says. Ishwara Paramaha Krishna. He is the top of the top of the top of the top. You can't get higher than that. So how much bliss is there just in Krishna's face? That lotus face, Manasimura Avrastam, may be revealed again and again within my mind. So this is what we're asking for in our Hare Krishna movement. We're asking for this. So people in the world, generally, people are asking for very foolish things. So this is, I'm sorry to say this, but I think it has to be said. Everything that we have, my dear friends, we want it. This is the meaning of karma. That we have custom ordered our body and our life. And everything that's happening to us, and everything that has happened to us, and all the circumstances of our life are due to our own desires. The New Agers, they say like that. They say the universe is fulfilling your desires. It's a fact. Although it's not just the universe, it's a person. It's Krishna. He's fulfilling everyone's desires. But we don't know what to desire. So I had a very interesting experience recently with one devotee. So there's one devotee I know, young in age devotee, and he was going to go to India for the first time on his own. So he was very excited. I'm finally going to go away from mommy and daddy and go to India and go on pilgrimage. I'm going to be on my own. So he worked for a while to save up some money to go. And he was telling his friends, you know, I'm going to get to be away from my family and be on my own, and I'm really going to be a man, and, you know, get to have my freedom and just be in Vrindavan by myself. So many of his family members were thinking that he was young, and he hadn't earned that much money, and he wouldn't have that much money to spend when he went to the Dham. So they gave him gifts. So his parents gave him some money, and his grandparents gave him some money, and lots of other people, different people gave him money. And a lot of people gave him money at the last minute. So he had arranged that some of his money was like sent to India, somebody was holding it for him there. So he wasn't carrying all of his cash with him. And the cash he carried with him was pretty much what people had given him as gifts. So what he had earned, he had sent wirelessly, and somebody was holding that for him in India, and what he had in his hands was the money that he had earned. So on the way to India, when he was waiting in an airport, somehow or other, when he went to the bathroom, he had a money belt that was under his clothes. So somehow when he went to the bathroom, he took off this money belt and just forgot about it and left it in the bathroom. And all of his money was stolen. It was returned to him, thankfully, with his passport. But every single bit of money was taken. So we were thinking about this. When we were thinking, he had had this idea, I'm going to go on my own. And now I'm a young man, I'm not a kid anymore. own and I'm going to do something independently. And on some level, he didn't really want to take anyone else's money. On some level, he wanted to go with his own money. You understand? That his own is, he had this desire to be independent. So, of course, when that money was stolen, it was quite a bit of money. When the money was stolen, he was devastated. But we were meditating on this. And that really, who takes off their money belt in the bathroom in an airport? Who does this? A very strange thing to do. And one of the devotees was saying, Matasmat Yogan Vapohanam Chak, Krishna is the source of all intelligence. And Krishna could understand that he was thinking, oh, this is a chance to be on my own. I want to be on my own. Okay, you want to be on your own, then you have to go on your own. You'll go only with the money you earned. You won't go with any gifts. Because that was what he wanted. But with all of us, we don't understand the results of what we want. If he understood that by wanting this thing, it means I'm going to lose all this money that was given to me, then he would have considered, is this really a wise desire? Does that make sense to everybody? Are you following? Do you understand? It's the same for all of us. We want things, but we don't understand what wanting those things mean. What will it mean? What will it really look like? What will it become like? I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to do this, I want to do that. And we don't understand what happens to us. Why does this happen to us? But everything that's happening to us is because of our own desires. Just that we're desiring things that are very foolish. We're desiring things that aren't so intelligent. So just to be very frank, if you're desiring to be an American, being American isn't all that great. There's nice things about being an American, but there's not nice things about being an American, too. So when you get the results of your desires, you see, you know, I don't know if this was really what I wanted. So in bhakti, we say we change our desires. And we don't desire anything materially, because is anybody here completely, totally, 100% happy with their life? Anybody look in the mirror and look at their body and go, perfect. But this is our own desires. We don't know what to desire. We don't know what's good for us. We really don't. So therefore, bhakti says, I should desire only to see the face of Krishna. That's all I need to desire. I don't need to desire anything else. Because everything is there. Whatever I want to enjoy, it's there. All the relationships, all the tastes, all the experiences. If you put together anything that we could possibly desire, it's there in Krishna without any negative, without any consequence. When I desire something in this world, it has a consequence. First of all, even when I get my desire, it's not so great, and there's some kind of price to pay. But with Krishna, you don't pay any price, frankly. I mean, you pay a price of giving up your pain, which appears to us to be a price, but it's not really. It's not really at all. It's like someone who's accustomed to smoking, you know, to give up smoking, it's just giving up pain. It's not giving up something that has any value. So this is what we should be desiring. This is this prayer. I'm desiring simply to see your face. So what specifically does that lotus face look like? So this is one of the great benefits of this philosophy from the Vedic literatures. Because all the religions in the world talk about God. Otherwise it wouldn't be a religion, they'd be something else. I mean, there are so-called spiritual groups that don't talk about God. But if you're going to say you're a religion, you have to have some idea of God. But what is God? So most of the religions in the world today simply say that God has no face, that he's formless. This impersonalism is very prevalent in the world's religions. Although in the scriptures it's not like that. Even in the Bible, it says that Moses saw God face to face like a friend speaks with another friend. Well, how do you see God face to face if he doesn't have a face? But what does his face look like? So there's not much information. You sort of have to guess. And so people will draw some pictures of some old men And in Islam, you're not even allowed to make any picture of even of Muhammad or to speak of God. You can't even make a picture of a flower if you're a strict Muslim. And the Jews are also like that. They can't even say the name God. They can't even write the word God. They write G-D. Because they say if you write down G-O-D, then the paper is sacred. What are you going to do with it? And they will not say any name of God. They just call him the name. In Hebrew, it's called Hashem, means the name. They'll just say, glory to the name. What name? Whose name? So when we have a description, it's okay. We have a description, what does God's face look like? And how are you going to meditate on this face if you don't know what the face looks like? So here the description is given. It is surrounded, vritam, by curling hair that is very dark blue, of yakta nila. Nila, of course, means like a sapphire. Glossy, snigda, and tinged with red, rakta. So it's very, very, very dark, bluish, with red highlights. The word vritam suggests that just as a lotus flower is surrounded with hovering honeybees, similarly the Lord's lotus face is encircled with curling locks that bounce around whenever he moves. The word gopya, by the gopi, indicates that his face is kissed again and again by either Sri Yashoda or by Sri Radha. So someone's kissing him. So his mother is kissing him or his lady love is kissing him. The word muhu, again and again, is relative to this word gopya, and it reads properly exactly where it is in the verse. This being the case, may that divine lotus face, muhush chumbitam, kissed repeatedly by the supremely fortunate gopi, in my mind, mama manasi, in my mind, avritasyam, may it manifest even once. So how are we going to get Krishna's face to manifest in my mind, that repository of all beauty, the repository of all rasa and all satisfaction, the supreme object of all desire? Are we just going to go about our business hoping that someday the Lord's face manifests in our mind? Let me just go about my business like anybody else, and someday there'll be a lightning bolt, and then the face of God will just appear in my mind. Or even if one just goes about executing religious rituals. You know, okay, I want to be a very pious person, and so I'll do my puja, and I'll ring my bell, and I'll say my mantras as a ritual, and thinking maybe someday the Lord's face will just manifest in my mind. Maybe you have a better chance of that than if you're just kind of going around like an ordinary person. But Krishna's face will manifest in our mind if we make an effort to meditate on Krishna's face. This is a very simple principle. Just like, why did I come here tonight? Because somebody invited me. It's very simple. It's not complicated. I didn't just wander around Houston. What's the name of this suburb?
Cyprus.
That's actually in the Mediterranean. But anyway, I didn't just wander around Houston and Cyprus looking for some random home and just open doors and say, can I come in? That would be rather odd. But I was invited. Yes? Somebody said, can you please come? And then someone came to give me a ride. And therefore I came. That means I came because I felt that somebody wanted me. Sometimes people force their way into a situation where they're not wanted. But that's not very pleasant, is it? Sometimes I've had people try to force themselves into my life when I really didn't want them in my life. Or I didn't want them right then. Maybe I wanted them, but not then. They could come in 2 hours. And they try to force themselves. You ever have people like this that try to force themselves in? And it's annoying. It's just irritating. Even if you like them, it's irritating. So we try to come where we're wanted, where we're invited. And most of us are kind of always checking like that. in some subtle way. Am I really wanted? You know, am I really invited? Or am I not wanted? Something that we're doing on a subtle level in our relationships all the time. So Krishna is a person. Srila Prabhupada says that Krishna has all the instincts of a human being. Or rather, we have all of his instincts because we're part of him. So Krishna also feels that way. Krishna is already in our heart. Krishna is already in our heart. But he only reveals himself when he's wanted. Krishna does not force himself on the living entity. Krishna is very polite. Unlike some of our pushy friends. Krishna is very polite. He's not pushy. He will not force his way into our life if we don't want him. So how do we get the face of the Lord to manifest in our mind? We invite him. And how do we invite him? We make an effort to think of him. Now please understand this principle, because it's very simple, but it seems to be very poorly understood. Bhakti yoga, the essence of bhakti yoga, is not so much the external rituals, which are certainly important. But the essence of bhakti yoga, according to Rupa Goswami, is to always... always think of Krishna and never forget him. Prabhupada says that's the beginning of sadhana bhakti. That means you make an effort. Krishna calls it abhyas yoga, practice yoga, which means the word abhyasa implies repetition. You make an effort to think of Krishna. Just like someone had to make an effort to invite me. They had to do something. They had to plan something. They had to talk to somebody. They had to send me a message. So we have to make an effort. We want to have to make an effort eternally. No. No. Just like once you have a very well-established relationship with someone, you don't have to make an effort to invite them. They just come over whenever they want, isn't it? Or maybe they even live with you. So we have people with whom we have relationships, they live with us. Our home is their home, and their home is our home. They don't have to come visit us. They're there. We don't have to make an effort to invite them anymore. The husband doesn't have to make an effort to invite his wife into his house. It's also her house. So it comes to a point in our relationship with Krishna that we're no longer doing this sadhana bhakti. We shouldn't think that Krishna consciousness means making some strong effort with determination eternally, and therefore we get tired. Oh, I have to make an effort with determination. Oh, I'm going to have to do this eternally. Oh, it's too much. But sadhana bhakti means we have to make an effort with determination to think about Krishna. So that means we make an effort to see the form of Krishna in our mind, as described in the scriptures, as depicted in the paintings and the deities and so forth. Prabhupada says we have this deity worship so that throughout the day we can think of the form of the deity. So we have that's not the only reason, of course. But Prabhupada would say that repeatedly. That's why we have this deity worship. And he'd say, when you're chanting Hare Krishna, can't you think of the deity? What is the difficulty? So to make an effort. And yes, in the beginning, it will seem unnatural and forced. In the beginning, it will seem unnatural and forced. Before the husband and wife live together, they have to make plans for the wedding. They have to do something. And it's some effort. So one has to make some effort to think of Krishna. And if one makes some effort to think of Krishna, it's not exactly that our imagination of Krishna's face in our mind becomes Krishna, but rather Krishna becomes attracted. By thinking of Krishna, it's basically sending out an invitation. Please come. Please come. Please come. I mean, look, this happens again even with normal human beings. If I think of you, you may pick that up subtly and call me on the phone. Have we had this experience? You're thinking very strongly of someone and the next minute they call you on the phone. This devotee was just telling me this with Kirtida. Now Kirtida, before she left her body, she said, I really would like to have Ritadvija's Tenpa Chamaraj is Girdhiraj, his Govardhan Shila. I like to leave my body with his Govardhan Shila. Immediately, Tenpa Chamaraj called on the phone. He said, I'm about to take the boys traveling across the country. I need someone to watch my Govardhan Shila. Would you watch my Govardhan Shila? So this operates on this sphere even. That if I make an effort to think about someone, somehow they get some awareness of that. What to speak of Krishna, who's already in my heart. So if I make an effort to think about Krishna, to meditate on Krishna's beautiful face, with his curling hair that moves when he walks, and it's blackish blue and tinged with red, and his cheeks are red, and you can decide if it's red from Mother Yasoda or Radharani kissing as your mother. So we'll continue and then we'll end here. Or else the word sadhya, always found in the previous verse, carries over to its definite conclusion in this present verse, thereby indicating may it always manifest. This intention can also be accepted. Finally, that lotus face is especially described thus, bimba bad raktanam, he whose lips are cherry red like the bimba fruit. If that form is manifest within my mind, I will be fully satisfied. Therefore it is said, about Lakshalabhai, the attainment of millions and millions of other types of benediction, alum, they have no use to me whatsoever. This is the meaning. This is definitely the message of the fifth verse. So when we find the face of God, then nothing else has any meaning to us. So of course, some people are afraid of meditating on Krishna for this reason. They're afraid, well, if I meditate on Krishna, then nothing else will have any meaning for me. I'll become a useless person. I'll leave my family and leave my work. And people are afraid like this. But this, of course, is not what Krishna told Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. He didn't say, think of me and go to the... Go. That was what Arjuna wanted to do. Arjuna said, let me leave the battlefield and just become a beggar. And Krishna said, no, mam anusmaram yujecha. Think of me and fight. Think of me in your life. Now, there may indeed come a time when Krishna says, okay, it's finished. In fact, there will come that time. Definitely for sure. For sure, there will be a time when Krishna says, you don't have any more responsibilities here. Your responsibilities here are done. You can come home now. That is for sure. Whether that will come only when it is time to leave this body or whether that time will come while we're still in this body, that I don't know. But until and unless Krishna says we're done, we have work to do here for him. Not because we're attached to it, not because we want something for ourselves, not because we're dissatisfied or we're in need, but as service. So we don't have to be afraid that we'll become irresponsible or something like that. Well, this is our bhakti, is to always think of the beautiful face of the Lord. And if one can't do it always, then at least some time to make a set time in the day. This is going to be a time of the day. I'm going to sit and read the Shastra, and I'm going to really think about what I'm reading. I really want to meditate on Krishna. This is going to be a time of the day when I worship my deities, and I'm going to really meditate on the deities. I'm not going to just do it officially. This is going to be my time that I chant, whether we're chanting in kirtan, whether we're chanting japa, and I'm really going to meditate on my chanting, really going to meditate on the form of the Lord and invite him. And you know what? If you keep inviting him, he will show up. Because he wants to come. He wants to. He wants to manifest. The only reason he doesn't manifest is he picks up that we don't really want him. That we really want so many other things. That we're kind of, well, maybe I want you. Not quite sure. Anyway, so that is the meaning of this verse. Very, very beautiful verse. And of course, the next verse ends with, at least let me see you once. Ekakshi drishya, drishya is to see. Ek once, of course. May you please come at least once. I want to see you. Of course, if Krishna comes once, you will want to see him again. I will not send him away. So I think it's going to be time now to sing the Dhammadrasika. If anybody has any questions or comments or anything else they want to discuss. The other day I was hearing Prabhupada said, if you don't ask questions, then you have to surrender. And that means you understand everything. Anybody have any questions at all?
Mataji, how you came to Krishna consciousness?
Everybody's asking me this question. The problem is it's a long story. That's the problem.
Can we have it in short form?
Short form, I heard the chanting, I read the Bhagavad Gita. That's a short form. So how long of an answer do you want me to give?
5-10 minutes.
Do I have 5 minutes? It's already 8:34.
Yeah. You can have all night long.
I'm just saying that out of politeness. Actually, I can't have all night long because I have another meeting early in the morning. And so if I go all night long, I won't be able to do anything tomorrow. Are you all interested in this?
Yes.
So you're just being polite. Okay, let's see. Well, how far back do I go? I think it started when I was 4 years old. And I said to my mother, why are we Jewish? And she said, you're Jewish because I'm Jewish. And I said, why are you Jewish? She said, I'm Jewish because my mother's Jewish. And I said, 4-year-olds, right? And I said, well, why is she Jewish? She said, because her mother was Jewish. Why is he? I kept asking this. And after a while, I said, well, that's dumb. I said, we should do something because it's true, not because just because all your mothers did it. So that was the start. I don't remember exactly how it was about 4. When I said what I wanted to do in life was find God. And consistently, when anybody said, what do you want to do with your life? I would always say, I just want to find God. When I was 8, I decided that I believed in reincarnation, which was sort of interesting because I didn't know anybody who believed in reincarnation, and I didn't really understand it. I just read it in the encyclopedia. This was way before Google. And I wrote a paper for my religious school that I went to in the afternoons, comparing the view of life after death in Judaism and reincarnation. And the rabbis didn't like it very much because I was really getting into reincarnation. And then when I was about 8 or 9, I asked my mother, must be about 8, I asked my mother if I could wear a sari. So we lived in Manhattan in New York City. We didn't have any direct friends who were Indian. There weren't very many Indians in America in those days. It wasn't until 1965 that the American government dropped the quota. They had a very tight quota for people from India before that. So there weren't any Indians. We didn't know anybody. But I would sometimes see tourists, because you see it in Manhattan, you see everybody from everywhere on the streets of Manhattan. So I must have sometimes seen some tourists. My mother had some friends who'd been to India, so she sewed me a sari, It was a saffron silk sari. So I used to wear that sometimes. I'd wear that on Halloween or something. And then when I was 12, this was 1967, my sisters were much older than me. And one of them was married when I was 2, and one was married when I was 3. And one of them lived in New York, right near 26 Second Avenue, maybe one block from the first temple. So I would go visit her all the time, and her husband met Srila Prabhupada then, and he didn't introduce me to Srila Prabhupada. He introduced me to some of the biggest rock and roll stars at the time. he didn't introduce me to Srila Prabhupada, but he met Srila Prabhupada several times. Anyway, there was a man there that had made a recording of Prabhupada chanting, but he was selling a record album. He had a shop there, and I would go to his shop, and I never bought anything at the shop, and he would sell Indian clothes and the Brijvasi posters of Krishna. So I would go there, look at the stuff, and listen to this recording of Prabhupada chanting. So that was my first direct contact with Krishna consciousness. I might have heard the devotees chanting at Tompkins Square Park, but I don't specifically remember. I'm assuming I did, because when I first went to the temple, I felt like I'd seen them before, and I used to go to Tompkins Square Park all the time. So then I think it was in 1969, I was 14 or 15, when I heard on the radio the Govinda song that we play in the morning for the deity greeting. And that's a very long story. But anyway, I ended up buying that record album. And I would listen to it all the time. And inside the album, there was a booklet, which I couldn't understand at all. I couldn't follow the philosophy in it at all. It didn't make any sense to me. But there were these beautiful paintings So I cut them out and put them on my wall. And then when I was in high school in the library, in the study hall, there was one boy there who was sort of a friend of a friend. He was reading Krishna book and had the same picture on the cover of the book that I had found in the record album. And I said, oh, I have that picture on my wall. He said, would you like to look at the book? So it was just a study hall. It was 45 minutes long. So I just borrowed the book and I went through it. I just looked at the pictures and then I had to give it back to him. He said, well, I go to a temple every Sunday. Would you like to come? Temple? What temple? I didn't put together all these things. So I'm kind of an adventurous person. I said, sure. And my parents were very liberal. A little too liberal. Anyway, they were very liberal. So, you know, this is inconceivable for Indians from India, that a 14-year-old girl says to her parents, I'm going to go, by that time we lived in New Jersey, I'm going to go on a bus to New York City with this boy from school. I only know his name. I don't know anything else about him. And we're going to go to some temple in New York. I don't think any Indian parents would allow that. But anyway, my parents were very liberal. And they just said, sure, okay. I mean, I didn't even know where I didn't even know this person, and I didn't even know where I was going. So anyway, we went into New York, and I went to the temple, and this devotee, Jadarani, preached to me for a couple hours. When we were coming back, I said to this boy, I agree with everything she said, but I couldn't explain it to anybody. I said I couldn't repeat it. I wouldn't be able to repeat it. So I went one more time, and there we met. There was a different woman there who preached to us. I asked her, what do I have to do to join? And I guess she thought I was with this boy. I think, you know, especially girls, it's hard sometimes to tell how old they are. Maybe she thought I was 18 or 20, I don't know. She must have thought I was with this boy. I think devotees especially tend to assume if we see a male and a female together that they're together, but out in the world it's not necessarily like that. So she said, well, we don't have any room here. You're going to have to get your own apartment. Like, my own apartment? I'm 14 years old, you know, in high school, living with my parents. My own apartment. I couldn't understand that at all. And I bought Easy Journey to Other Planets because I thought it was about, like, mystic yoga travel, which it wasn't, of course. So I didn't read more than a couple pages. And then I didn't go back to the temple. I thought, what's the point? I have to get an apartment. Unfortunately, I didn't have the Sukriti. She didn't tell me to chant Hare Krishna or to follow the principles. So I really make a point because of that whenever I'm talking to new people to say something about the four principles and chanting Hare Krishna, because she didn't say anything to me like that. She didn't talk about practicing Krishna consciousness on my own. I think in those days of the movement also, people just, to become a devotee meant you have to live in the temple. That was how they were thinking. So after that, if people asked me, what do you believe, I'd say Hare Krishna. No, apparently nobody knew about Hare Krishna in those days. And then they'd say, well, do you practice that? And I go, no. I didn't even know what it was to practice. I didn't know anything. So then, when I went to college at 17, right before I went to college, I used to meditate regularly. I used to do my own kind of concocted meditation where I was trying to merge with God. I thought if you want to find God, you have to become God. So at one point in my meditation, I felt that I was starting to lose my identity. And I got very frightened. And I decided I didn't want to lose my identity. I didn't want to merge. And then I thought, well, if I don't want to merge with God, then what's left for me? I thought my whole life I wanted to find God. And here I felt like I was just about to find him, and I got scared. And I said, I don't want to do that. I thought, what am I going to do? I thought, well, I guess then I'm just going to be a materialist. There's nothing else left but to be a materialist. So I tried very hard for a couple months to be a materialist, which was a very unhappy experiment, at the end of which I just said, you know, I don't know who you are, but whoever you are, help me. And at that point, I was with my best friend, and she went to visit her boyfriend in his room, and her boyfriend's roommate had Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita sitting on the floor. And I looked at that. I said, oh, isn't that the Hare Krishna book? And he said, yeah. Would you like to borrow it? I said, sure. He said, well, I never read it. I bought it from somebody on the street, never looked at it. So I took it back to my room, and I stopped eating and sleeping. I just read that book. And I just said, this is what I wanted. I'm skipping a lot of things anyway. I said, this is what I've always wanted. This is what I've always wanted. I felt as if things that had been in my heart, not even known to me, were there in the book. I felt like this was something I had always known, but I didn't know that I knew. I don't know how to explain it any better than that. It's like, yeah, I knew that, and that makes sense. And it was hard because I didn't understand any of the terms. You know, I mean, who's Duryodhana? And I couldn't pronounce anything. I had no idea what the story of the body of food or anything. So the college I was in had a work-study program where 2 months out of the year you had to have a job, a paid or volunteer. So I got a job in Chicago. My college was in Vermont. I got a job in Chicago being a museum guide at a science museum. I looked for the temple there. Again, this is before the internet, so you just called, not like any of you are my age. Anyway, you called information on the phone. But I called information for Chicago, but the temple was in a suburb, so that there was no temple. You know, I looked for the Radha Krishna temple. They gave me the phone number of some Indian man named Radha Krishna. He said, oh, you want to come to my house? I said, no, no. You know? So I thought there's no temple, you know. Meanwhile, I was starting to chant from the record album, and I was going to my job, and I was chanting while at my job. And when I had 2 weeks left in my time, I ran into a brahmachari on the train. It turned out the temple was 2 blocks from where I was staying, but there was a train in between. So they would go to get on the train. They wouldn't walk on the street. So then I went to the temple, and one of the brahmacharis there preached to me, and I said, I don't know if I'm ready to surrender. And I came back 2 days later. I said, okay, I'm ready. And I talked to the temple president, and he said, we have these 4 principles. Do you want to follow them? I said, yes. And he said, we get up early in the morning. And I said, well, I've always woken up. My father used to get up like by 5. So I said, I've always woken up early. So then I stayed, without my parents' knowledge, I stayed in the temple for 2 weeks while I was working. And I remember that night I went to the Artik and they put a sari on me. We didn't have real saris then. We just have sheets of poly cotton cloth. Very heavy. Very, very heavy cloth. And everybody wore saffron. So, you know, they give me this heavy saffron poly cotton cloth. And it was like 25 pleats from here to here. And it was tucked in about this much. It's really heavy. And the cloth, the only way you could keep it on your head was to put a safety. You couldn't clip it. Your hair would have pulled out all your hair. You had the safety pin. And then after some time, it would kind of move. So that's what I was wearing. And I went to the kirtan. I started dancing. And it started coming out. You know? And I didn't know what to do. I never did. You know? Fix this thing. Oh, there was this 4-year-old girl looking at me like, what's wrong with you? And the next morning I went to Mangal Artik, and then I said, this is what I want. Because when I was working the 2 months, I was riding the train every day. I'm seeing everybody on the train. I'm in college, and I'm thinking about what I want to do with my life. So this was 1973. This was really the women's liberation movement was quite strong then. So it was quite a mood of having, even for a girl, having a career. So I was thinking like that, you know, what kind of career do I want to have? What do I want to do with my life? And looking at the people on the train, and they all look miserable. They're all going to work, and they're like... And I thought, so I'll get a great career, and then after 10, 15 years, I'm going to look like all these other guys. And then how am I, you know, I'm not going to like my life. So I was on the train, I was chanting also. I mean, not like chanting job, I didn't know about job. I was just singing from the record. And I was like, please, please, give me something where I'll be happy to wake up in the morning. So I went to one Mangal Artik, and there they are, you know, 4:30 in the morning, singing and dancing. I'm like, yes. And then I loved the philosophy. I mean, just going to the classes, I really just, the philosophy just answered everything. I was just fell in love with Srila Prabhupada's books and with the philosophy and with the whole lifestyle, because that was what I've been looking for my whole life. How can I be spiritual 24 hours a day? How can I find God? You know, how can I find God in everything that I do? And then, because I wasn't 18, I went back to college, finished out the year. And as soon as I finished the year, I dropped out of college and came back and moved in the temple. I ended up moving in the temple the day that Kishore Kishore were installed. That's another long story why I ended up moving in the temple on that day. But yeah, in college, I tried to wear a sari. Of course, there weren't saris. Sorry. Just went to a fabric store, and I just bought some fabric. You know. I looked really funny because it was too short, so it was like up to here, and then it was too short this way, so the saris I bought only made like 2 pleats in them. Anyway, I definitely looked very funny, but it was some effort. So I was wearing a sari and tilak, going to my classes. So that was how I joined the Hare Krishna movement. That's the medium story. The long story would take over an hour, but that's the medium story. Is that all right?
Thank you very much.
One question.
Yes.
So when did you meet Prabhupada?
Well, that's like 2 hours.
Maybe having 2 minutes.
No, you can't have in 2 minutes. But the first time I met Prabhupada was in the summer of 1974. So it was about a year after I joined his school. So I got initiated in 73 through the mail. Actually, I got initiated without even asking to be initiated. The town president had recommended me to Srila Prabhupada without my knowledge. And he just came and said, Prabhupada's accepted you as his disciple. I'm like, oh. Okay. A second initiation I got from Prabhupada personally in 1974. So we got to be in 1974, my father came, and my husband, my father, and I went into Srila Prabhupada's room and had, there were some other devotees there also. We had personal darshan of Prabhupada. And then again, we had moved to the New York temple in the beginning of 75, and again we met with Prabhupada in 75 in his room, and then I was with a small group of devotees at the airport in 75. And then we saw him in the summer of 75 in Philadelphia, which is where my father became a life member. And I got Gaji Mantra. My father went on a walk with Srila Prabhupada. And then the last time I saw Srila Prabhupada was in 1976 when he came to New York for the Rath Yatra on Fifth Avenue. Until then, Prabhupada didn't come to America after that.
So there was no opposition from your family?
Well, I told you it was a short story. So yeah, when I came back from Chicago, I came back from Chicago wearing neck beads. First thing my mother said when she got me at the plane is, what's on your neck? It's the first thing she said. And then I said, oh, now I'm a vegetarian. So that was... Now it's not that uncommon, you know, Bill Clinton's become a vegan, but in those days, I didn't know anybody who was vegetarian. So my mother was really upset about that. And then I told her, I said, at the end of the semester, I'm dropping out of college. Okay, you guys know how you feel if your kids told you they were dropping out of college? Okay, Jewish parents and Indian parents are very similar. So my mother was just... She was very unhappy. Let's put it that way. And not only am I dropping out of college, I'm dropping out of college to move into some Hare Krishna temple. No one knew what Hare Krishna was. She had no idea what it was. It's nothing. And she had some sense that I'm, you know, converting from my religion, which was just also, for my mother, being Jewish was much more important than being American. Her whole identity was that she was Jewish. She was born in Jerusalem, and My family ran a Jewish food company, so her whole life was dedicated to Jewish causes and Jewish charities. And she ended up giving millions and millions of dollars to Jewish charities. So it was, you know, for her that was everything. It was almost like if I said, you know, I was going to become a Russian citizen during the Cold War. You know, it was very heavy for her. Later, she said, at least you didn't become a Muslim or a Christian. Right. She said, at least the Hindus have never persecuted the Jews. That was her. But at first, she was hysterical. My father was completely opposite. My father said, I'm so glad you're looking for God. He said, when I was 18, I was looking for God. He said, but then I got married. My parents were 18 when they got married. He said, then I got married, I got into the business, and I forgot about it. He said, I'd rather you find God in Judaism, but that's not what's important. What's important is that you find God. So that was from day one, my father was like that. He was there was a couple years when my father almost became a devotee, where he was following the principles, and he was chanting. But so I had a lot of opposition from my mother. For 8 years, my mother was highly antagonistic. Very highly. We never had her meet Srila Prabhupada because she was so antagonistic. I remember one time she came to visit, and my husband said to her, you know, I don't know if I want you to come visit anymore. He said, when you're here, you just want your daughter to leave this movement and leave me and leave her son. And she said, well, no one wants her to leave her son. you know, my husband said, sorry, you know, if you're trying to break up our marriage and you're trying to take my wife away from this movement, then you're not going to be welcome in our house anymore. He was very happy. But not with my father. My father would come to Bhagavatam class, and he would take prasadam. Like that. And then with my two sisters, my oldest sister lived in Israel from the time I was 1 year old, so I didn't have much relationship with her. And she was just friendly, but we weren't that close anyway. My other sister, the one who lived near 26 Second Avenue, she ended up getting divorced and remarrying a rabbi. And then she became extremely antagonistic towards me. So she performed my funeral. So that was, I had a lot of opposition from my, and she and I had been really, really, really close when I was growing up. So she considered that I was dead. After her oldest son died, I was able to connect with her again. And then when she was dying of cancer, she agreed to see me. So she saw me once after she got the diagnosis, and then once about 3 weeks before she died, she let me come visit her house, which was amazing. I slipped some Radhaquin water into her medicine. Though I knew I couldn't say anything about Krishna when I was there. So when I was there, I kept talking about my children, and I would say, Madhava, now his name is Murari, but at the time his name was Madhava, my daughter was named Jamuna then. So I was saying, you know, and Madhava did this, and Jamuna did this, and Keshava did this, and afterwards my mother said, why are you talking so much about your children? So I was trying to say Krishna's name. So she was very, I got to have heavy, heavy opposition from my sister and my mother. So my mother was highly opposed for 8 years, and for another 2 years she was moderately opposed, and then she became favorable. She became favorable. You guys are going to think it's really funny. My husband and I, by that time, had owned a house. Before that, we were just living in ashrams. My mother couldn't relate to that. My parents were middle-upper class. You know, she couldn't relate to this. What is my daughter doing, sleeping on the floor, living in an ashram, and selling Hindu books in the subways? You know, just she couldn't get that. Didn't make any sense to her. So then we owned a house. You know, finally we bought a house, and we had a car. And my husband had a regular job, and I was running a nursery school. So that made sense to her, that she could relate to. You know, people said, "What's your daughter doing?" My daughter's living in a closet in a Hare Krishna temple and selling books in the subways. You know, she couldn't deal with that. But my daughter's got a house and she runs a nursery school and her husband's a software engineer. And she could handle that. But the real turning point came when this is so funny. We were visiting her, and while we were visiting her, she wanted to watch the news, and we didn't leave the room. We stayed in the room and watched the news with her on television. And after that, she was fine. She decided we were normal. She ended up giving a lot of money for our Gurukul in North Carolina. She gave probably well over $60,000 for us to start Gurukul. And she ended up having a very auspicious death. In fact, more than my father did. When my father was becoming a devotee, he was already in his 60s, and he separated from my mother, and he was living basically as a renunciate, and later on some other woman captured him, unfortunately, which was very unfortunate. So when my mother was dying, my one sister had already died of cancer, and my other sister was in Israel with a heart condition, not allowed to travel, and my parents were already divorced at that time. So I was the only one, and I was with my mother all the time. For the last 3 weeks, I was with her all day. So I didn't want to say Krishna, but I would say Gopal. I knew if I said Krishna, she wouldn't like it. So I was telling her all these leelas, but I was just always calling Krishna Gopal. I mean, I knew she knew what I was talking about, but anyways, she was cool with that. I was telling her the Ramayana, and I was always playing Prabhupada chanting. She couldn't eat. She couldn't eat or drink. So, you know, she was fasting. And a few days before she died, my daughter came, and my daughter's a Bharatanatyam dancer. And for the whole nursing home, my daughter did this, all these dances of Krishna's pastimes. It was basically, we did a whole Harinam Sankirtan in the form of a Bharatanatyam dance. But it was a form that everybody could accept. you know, this cultural, and the whole nursing home. Yeah, everybody, all the nurses and doctors and the patients. That was incredible experience. That was incredible. These patients that were normally like this, you know, they were alert. You know, amazing experience. And my mother's roommate turned out that she had a nephew who was a devotee. And right after my daughter did that dance, the next day was a codicy. And the woman ended up getting sick that day, not eating or drinking anything that day. And she died in the room on a codicy. Right after seeing all this lila in the dance. And then my mother got very serious. And I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but it was incredible what Krishna did. Krishna basically, in the last few hours, just severed all of her attachments to the world, one after another. And we ended up just chanting with her. She was in full consciousness. So she died just in full consciousness, hearing the chanting, even though she'd been so opposed for so many years. And she had nothing. You know, you go in a nursing home. I mean, my parents had been multi-millionaires, but my mother had given everything away. All of her beautiful furniture and silver, and it was all already given away. She was just in a little room with one little box of clothes, and there was nothing there. None of the family was there. I was the only one there. You know, she hadn't eaten for months. She looked like a skeleton. My mother had been a beauty queen when she was young, one trip around the world and stuff. That was all gone. Everything just... It was very incredible. She had an amazing passing from her body. I guess more so than my father. You never know. But yeah, it was hard. To become a devotee in those days meant walking away from everything. It meant leaving your friends, your job, your education, your family, everything, and moving into an ashram. Living in a room with 12 other people and just your stuff in a box, wearing those very funny poly cotton clothes, and just going out and selling books or going on Harinam. That was, you know, what we did. That was about it. Anything else? Anybody want to know?
When we do book distribution generally, like you know, I sometimes feel giving Bhagavad Gita to somebody who doesn't know anything is a bit too heavy, because even people who are familiar, Bhagavad Gita becomes a bit too heavy to go through, read, and all that.
You could always give them one of the little books, or give them Science of Self-Realization, or something like that.
Right.
But hey, you know, when Prabhupada was on the planet, and he was translating the books, in order to get a good deal on printing, you have to print like 10,000 books or 20,000 books. So what were we going to do with 20,000 books? We had to sell them. So we were out in the public selling Chaitanya Charitamrita Anchalila Volume 5. Do you know what's Chaitanya Charitamrita Anchalila Volume 5? If you don't, go take a look. And we were out there at the airports with the meat eaters and the wine drinkers and giving them the last volume of the Anchalila of Chaitanya Charitamrita. Yes. We were giving them Nectar Devotion, which is, practically speaking, incomprehensible. It's basically incomprehensible. So I think now, you know, what the BBT does now is what they print in large quantities are like Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 1, Volume 1, and Bhagavad Gita and things like that. But you can always, you know, the BBT tries to publish books that are more introductory, like Science of Self-Realization, which was based on Prabhupada's lectures and articles that had appeared in Back to Godhead. And then you have the little books that are also lectures. So there are also books that you can distribute that are more introductory. And we used to distribute our Back to Godhead magazine to the public. You know, that was specifically an introductory material for the public. But of course, you know, you don't know about Bhagavad Gita. Just the other day at the temple, on Govardhan Puja Day, there was this man at the temple, he wasn't more than 25. And he had come to the temple because his landlady was Indian, and she had invited him to come to the temple. And he was a typical southerner. He's a pretty simple guy. Worked in some sort of machine manufacturing plant. Not the kind of person I normally would think that would come to a temple. So he was sitting there just reading Bhagavad Gita. It didn't look like he had enough money to buy one. He was just reading the one from the table, and then he put it back before you. And he said, as soon as I saw this book, he said, my brother has this book in his closet. And he just kept, he was just like opening up at random and reading it. So like I said, the book that changed me was Bhagavad Gita, and I couldn't, I mean, really, I don't think I could make heads or tails out of it, if you really want to. I don't think I understood anything. And I certainly didn't understand anything of, I don't know if I still understand anything, that's another discussion. But I certainly didn't understand the terms. You know, Brihaspati, who's that? What is it? What's going on in chapter one was completely confusing to me. I couldn't understand. I mean, it was probably 2 years before I got a sense of who the people were and who these stories were. But I still thought, would you change my life? So these books operate on different levels and layers. These books are not bits of black ink on white paper. They're Krishna, and they relate with the person according to where that person is. So even though from the perspective of today, when I read Bhagavad Gita 41 years ago, I really didn't understand it at all. It was the most magical and incredible book that I had ever read when I was reading it. And I had no doubt that it was spoken by God. I just know. I just like, there's no one else but God who could have spoken this book. I felt like reading this book was like opening a door to my heart and having some sort of eternal truth that I was always aware of but couldn't articulate being put in front of me. So I don't think you need to concern yourself with that, because ultimately understanding comes from Krishna in the heart, who makes the meaning of the Shastra available to us. And as we progress in Krishna consciousness and you keep reading the same books, they're not the same books. I keep finding new things in the same books, and now it's like, where did that sentence come from? But it strikes you in a different way, doesn't it? And you find deeper and deeper levels of meaning. So you can take it one of two ways. If you give Bhagavad Gita, let it act in its own way. It will do that, and if you're not able to feel happy with that, then you can take the introductory books. So I'm getting all sorts of not very subtle signs here that I should end. Thank you very much. Maybe this is the first time.